none of you get it. Do you know what the secret of life is?
No, what?
This.
Your finger?
One thing. Just one thing. You stick to that and everything else don't mean shit.
That's great, but what's the one thing?
That's what you gotta figure out.
To my knowledge, there's nobody grazing as many acres under solar spread across as many sites as across as many states as we are today. And one thing we're very grateful for is we don't see that we made a lot of mistakes. We didn't get the wrong equipment or go about it wrong. There was just a hell of a learning curve.
Hey guys, we'll get into the podcast in just a minute. However, I am looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Hey guys, today our guest is Trent Hendricks. Trent runs Cabrejo Ranch with his wife Rachel and a passel of kids. They raise grass-feed cattle and sheep in more than just a sustainable manner, but in a holistically managed regenerative model. Trent is vice president on the board of directors for the American Grass-Fed Association. As part of the AGA, he is also involved with the Business and Finance Committee, Grass-Fed Standards and Certification Committee, and the Marketing Committee. I have a feeling that Trent is involved in a number of projects and organizations that I do not yet know about. Trent, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. And so, in brief, and I know you're involved in a lot of things, succinctly, how would you describe what it is that you do?
Well, succinctly is the rub. I have an insatiable curiosity in all things, and I'm on a journey to learn as much as I can. That's what I do.
Hey, I love that. You're working with grass-fed. What are there a few of the things that you might have outside of raising cattle and solar?
Yeah, so done a lot of things over the last few decades, virtually all in food or agriculture in some fashion. And so really, it's just interesting how one's journey through life, you can start to look back and see, you know, the line that weaves through them all that connects them and helps make the journey make more sense. And so in that path, you know, it's like one door leads to another door and timing's everything. And, you know, it's just so hard to see into the future. But, you know, I grew up in a family of construction, custom home building and some land development on the East Coast, and never wanted to do that. I always wanted to be in agriculture, and you know, I didn't really see how to do it, and considered trying to become a vet, but I don't enjoy the traditional route through academia, and so bought a tractor trailer and started hauling cattle, and grew that into a number of different trucks, and started to have a family, and wanted to do raw milk for our children. And you know, the deal with my wife was that we were going to do it, providing I was able to produce the milk ourselves and milk the cows. And we'd always kept a small livestock operation. So the next day, I just went out and bought a couple of cows because that seemed like the thing to do. And that led to cheese making, which led to doing, you know, surprisingly well in some competitions, which led to media opportunities, which led to, you know, recognition, which ultimately led to some consulting opportunities. And, you know, it's just been this gradual path. It doesn't make any sense until you start to look at it and see that it has all been going in a similar direction. And, you know, the longer you're in it, the deeper your relationships and opportunities typically come from relationships. And, you know, so we've been very heavily involved in the Savory Institute, and which is leading the movement of regenerating grasslands around the world. And I also am an advisor to Savory Institute, and we're one of their hubs. They have hubs all over the world for outreach and education, and that's what led to ultimately that, and through personal networks, led to the opportunity to do the solar grazing thing. And I've been doing a lot of consulting to large food companies, and was just burning out on that, and saw the opportunity to, really directly hands-on have the impact that I just wasn't being able to have in other ways. And so, it's just been a journey. So we do grass-fed beef and cattle on our own ranches in the Ozarks, but we also graze sheep under solar panels in quite a few states in the Midwest and South. And, we do a lot of regenerative consulting to producers and food companies, and we're founders in a small little meat company that we're just launching with, doing some meat sticks and nut butters and things, all regeneratively sourced, and out there chasing opportunity, trying to be the difference that we see the world need in our point of view.
That's good stuff. The word regenerative is one that comes up a lot with just about everything that I've read about and when you post. What does, to the average person, how would you explain what regenerative means?
That's a good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because a lot of people, we're so numb to buzzwords and propaganda and agendas and all this other stuff, and so this is a great opportunity. So you basically have three states or conditions that something can be in. It can be in a degrading state, it can be in a sustaining state, or it can be in a regenerating state. So it's either losing in value, it's holding its current value, or it's increasing in value. And so, conventional land management often leads to a degrading state. And the word sustainability has been popular for a good decade now. And everybody thought that was the thing, that was the solution, let's sustain. But the challenge, the real problem, is that we were sustaining the rate of degradation. And so it's only when we shift to a regenerating model where we actually begin the healing process, and we begin to create more opportunity, better soils, leading to better food production, leading to better natural biodiversity, better water holding capability, water purification capabilities. And the way that we set up a regenerating model is by creating a decision-making framework, set up a context, which is not quite goals, but, in that frame of mind, it's easier for people not familiar with it to think in the term of a goal. And we say, what's that future to goal? What do we want the land to look like? What do we want our life to look like? And then we use it, really as our North Star, and say, okay, if I make a decision left or right, forward or backward, is it going to get me closer to that goal or take me further away from it? And it becomes a really simple way of making decisions. And, maybe we don't use it on every minor detail, but certainly as the process becomes more important, we want to use that. And when we've been using it for a long time, we realize that subconsciously, innately, we're always using it. Even when it comes to our health and diet, is the short-term reward of eating or drinking X worth the long-term ramifications of my health journey? It becomes a decision-making framework. And that's where regenerative, it's in danger of being greenwashed a little, as it's just become a very hot buzzword in food and ag space. But at its core, at its origin, it's really a massive mental shift in thinking, saying, okay, it's not about just limiting the loss of topsoil. It's actually about first stopping the loss of topsoil and then rebuilding and replacing the lost topsoil. And, it's kind of like the old adage, the best way to get out of debt is to stop digging the hole deeper.
Right.
It's a similar mantra.
Looking at what you've described here, regenerative is like when you're regenerating, you're rebuilding, but it's entirely possible to come to a piece of land that is whatever state, let's just call it the natural state, but you can dramatically improve that soil. You can dramatically change all kinds of things. What would be a good concept for that when you're actually just going into, let's just say, 50 acres, and everything you build turns it into, rather than just being whatever it was, but you turn it into just 50 acres of just lushness. How would you describe that?
Yeah, so there's leading and lagging indicators that we would follow. So the Savory Institute has done some very groundbreaking work in developing their ecological outcome verification system, EOV. And by using EOV, you can develop an ecological health index for a piece of land. So when we go into a new piece of land, whether it's part of our ranch or leased property or solar field, we would create an EHI, an ecological health index, through baselining that property. We would identify the snapshot in time of the health of that property. And then we would evaluate, you know, what are we going to do with this property? You know, where are the weak links? Where are the opportunities? What are the log jams to success? And we just go through this process and we create a plan for that property. And the leading indicators would be things like plant spacing and plant diversity and total biodiversity, you know, bugs, insects, butterflies, frogs, whatever. And we see these things, the nature coming back in and the holistic health of that interaction. And then we have lagging indicators, which would be like soil organic matter or carbon testing that would show us that we're long-term building soil, literally building soil. The organic matter comes up, the water holding capability comes up, it doesn't sheet off the top, it absorbs it and holds it, and we do water infiltration testing. So there's just a number of ways to look at that land's health, and then we would manage accordingly to create the conditions that lead to the outcomes we desire, and we would just evaluate that land annually. We do the lagging indicators every 5 years, but we do the leading indicators on an annual basis. And then, of course, through the year, we're doing what we would call short-term monitoring, where we're evaluating and adjusting according to the realities of the season and the weather. It takes a good, you know, here in the Ozarks, they say it takes 10 years to get an average year. And so obviously there's a lot of variations in heat and humidity and rainfall. And so we take that into consideration and we adjust on the fly, but we start with a pretty good plan. And then we track the proposed plan with the realities and we evaluate that and, you know, try to learn as much as we can about it. Every property and every year is a little bit different. And so, you know, over time though, for example, a lot of the traditional way of grazing cattle in this country has been, you know, you just put so many animals in a field of so big a size and, you know, you leave them there and they just go around and eat whatever grows when it grows. There's a lot of challenges in that because the plan of nutrition for the animals tends to vary unless it's just woefully understocked. You know, it's, they eat what they want to eat until it's not available and then they eat what's left. And so the nutritional values really change a lot. So the performance of the animal, therefore, is affected. And also, too, you're always having an impact. It's like working with a horse. Everything you do means something to the horse. You may not know it, but the horse does. And so the land is the same way. And we may say, well, you know, it's doing this and doing that. But the reality is if the animal is eating what they want, chances are that's the species we prefer and we'd like to see grow in greater abundance. But if they only eat what they want and they don't eat what they don't want, which one actually was favored in that process? You know, the undesirable species now has a heads up. It, you know, it's been allowed to grow and create roots and drop seed and the desirable species is always being, you know, chewed off as quickly as it can put its new shoots out and ends up depleting its reserve energies and discontinues growing or becomes very unhealthy. And you have open spots between plants called plant spacing increases. And that's a negative thing because now you have exposed ground to the air, to the sun. You can have soil capping and, you know, it just begins to degrade and degrade and degrade.
Right.
So what we can do, and that's typically not a natural situation anyway, you know, in nature, we had large herds that were more or less constantly on the move and typically wouldn't come back for a long time to the grass. So everything got eaten or trampled or dunged on and it had an equal rest period to recover. And that's optimal. So today we replicate that in a number of ways. A lot of people use temporary electric fence to tighten up a group of animals and to control that movement to replicate that natural rhythm. A lot of times, for example, with our grazing on solar fields, we'll just deliver a large group of animals to a specific amount of ground, and pull the entire animal group back out within a specific time period to do that pressure and release, which is interesting because, you know, my journey into this whole new way of thinking and managing natural resources was simultaneous to learning a lot more about natural horsemanship. And the techniques are so similar, pressure and release.
Mm-hmm.
Release is totally ineffective if you didn't have pressure first, but continual pressure without the release is destructive. And it's the same thing in our human relationships. It's the same thing in managing natural resources, training horses, dogs. It doesn't matter. You know, it's a core tenet that we choose to operate by, and understanding that allows us to have much greater influence. Typically, as modern humans, we think it's all about control, but control is an illusion. It's only a heightened ability to influence conditions and situations that lead to the outcomes that we desire. And that's the beauty of this system. It's the only system that I'm aware of in the world that is solely based on outcomes. Through this whole process, they actually have a consumer-facing brand called Land of Market. The Savory Institute has this Land of Market program for consumer-facing products that some of the larger brands are getting behind now. And it's just about outcomes. There is no such thing as regenerative beef, but there is beef that has been raised and produced on land that is regenerating, and the proper management of those critters is what encouraged the movement to that regeneration. And so it's just really important to understand only land, essentially, from a simple point of view, only land regenerates. The products that are produced on that land were tools or byproduct of the regeneration. They aren't actually regenerative of themselves.
I see where you're going. It's like you're almost changing the goal. The goal is no longer raising cattle. The goal is making the land better. What do we do to make that better? Oh, we use cows. Guess what? We can sell these cows for food and help sustain our goal of improving the land.
You're exactly right. And what's so interesting is, you know, over the last, you know, I've been involved in this food and ag space, largely in the specialty sector, for several decades. And, you know, early on, it was just, you know, before grass-fed became a thing, you know, there's a couple of people out there, Weston A. Price Foundation and Eat Wild and
right.
Some of these others that were talking about this, and people began to search it out. And, you know, it was really about at that time when grazing in a managed way really started to gain attention, it was all about lowering the cost of production. And then the health movement got excited and retailers and brands and others began to see opportunity. And then a premium was created. And then, you know, we had in the adoption curve, it went pretty big time. And now everybody wanted to produce grass fed regardless of the cost to get that premium. And they used the entire amount of the premium, if not more, in the cost of production. And now we've gone the other way to where, you know, that premium doesn't often cover the additional cost of production. And we say, well, then it must be a flawed production system. You know, it's people anywhere in the country are producing grass fed animals year round, and that's not natural. So, you know, we lose sight of things, and that's why the context is so critical. You know, have that North Star. Are we working in sync with nature or not? And the beauty of this regenerative system is that it allows us to focus on those outcomes. And as that land is improving, in a perfect world, in the early days, it'd sure be nice to get a premium. But that premium shouldn't be to cover our cost of production. That should be for being an early adopter, for being courageous, you know, being a herd quitter, swimming upstream. And ideally, if we really truly incorporate the right principles with good wisdom and understanding, the outcome should be that 50 acres that, you know, we're using as a reference earlier, instead of raising 15 cows in 5 years, maybe it's raising 30. That's where the land steward has the real upside potential, because it's not about chasing a premium. It's about doing the right thing by nature and reaping the rewards of the regeneration, because nature always wants to heal itself, always. I mean, you know, here's another example of regeneration that I use often, and I think it'll help. You could take the most incredible, highest producing corn ground in Iowa And who knows how deep the topsoil is. Maybe it's 12 feet, 20 feet. Just amazing black dirt. And you could say, wow, that's super productive. And yet, year over year, when they're growing corn there and they're spraying chemical and killing off all life in that soil, it's degrading. And you could take an abandoned warehouse parking lot with cracks in the blacktop with grass and weeds starting to grow in it, and that parking lot is beginning to regenerate. So you could actually do an EHI, and even though the corn ground is so much better at producing grain than the parking lot, the corn ground would be degrading and the parking lot would be regenerating. Doesn't mean that they're equal today, but the trajectory, the trend line is negative on the corn ground and positive on the parking lot.
Right. You talked about the cost of raising cattle on grass-fed. And one of the things you said was that it's not natural for grass-fed year-round. Is that what I heard correctly?
Well, yes, but it probably needs some explanation so that you don't, you know, I don't get lots of hate mail. You know, the reality is that we have different weather patterns. We have different soil types. We have different climatic conditions in this wonderful country of ours. And so in order to be able to produce something year-round, you know, we need certain conditions. So basically, we've got the 50th parallel, and within a couple hundred miles north and south of there is the ground that, outside of elevation differences, is going to be able to produce grass that will help a cattle gain weight most of the year.
Can you tie this back to the grazing and roaming patterns of the buffalo?
Yeah, I think you can. You know, it's like the grain harvest. You know, as the custom harvesters start in Texas in the spring and end up in Montana in the fall. Mm-hmm. You know, they're following the ripening of that grain. And it's oversimplified, I get it, but the point is there. And so, you know, as the grasses ripen and grow, and, you know, the animals' behavior patterns would be adjusted by that. Now, you can also look and say, well, not every animal traversed the continent every year, and that would be correct. But we're looking at grazing ruminants,
right,
as really this whole process. So, you know, our white-tailed deer may live in, you know, 1 to 5 square miles in our Ozarks here, but they're a browsing animal. And, you know, half the year they get fat, half the year they starve. You know, it's just the reality of it all. They eat different things.
But they also have a more diverse diet.
True, true. And, you know, they live off, in our country, they live off the acorns half the winter, most of the winter. And you can see when there's fresh snow, all the big oak trees have the snow piled up underneath them with the deer looking for acorns.
When they are eating the acorns, when they're masticating that, do they have a way of spitting out the kernels, or the shell rather, and just taking in the nut, or do they digest all of it?
I think it passes through, digests or otherwise, goes in one end and comes out the other.
Okay.
And it's kind of like when an owl or a coyote scat, you know, you can see the fur and the tail of a mouse. It's still there.
Or like my dog, when it used to eat grasshoppers and crickets when it was little, you'd see the legs.
Right.
Okay, so the other thing is that I wanted to touch on was the expense of raising grass-fed beef. Now, let's take government out of the picture and let's just look at land.
Yeah, let's.
If you're doing it in the absence of a taxation, other additional expenses, if you're just looking at, say, 10 cows on 50 acres, it would seem to me it's almost drop dead inexpensive to have those cows out there grazing that land under plenty of land. They're eating everything. You don't have to do anything to provide additional fuel for them, except for maybe if they're going to be contained, you have to harvest the grass so they have something to eat throughout the winter. We're going to disregard the fact that some people will feed them grain. So if you're doing grass-fed beef and you have the supply for the winter, the hay, that seems to me that that's a pretty low cost. But I know there's a lot of things that come into play, but take that out aside, if you're going to raise cattle and you're going to feed them corn, now you have a whole level of infrastructure that you have to put in place. You have to raise the corn, you have to harvest it all, you have to process it, and then you're going to turn around and feed it to the cows. It seems to me that without artificial influences, grass-fed is just lower cost, more productive, more healthy, but it's only when you artificially try to tweak things that it becomes unbalanced.
Yeah, I think that last comment there is the real clincher. And if we unpack your earlier comments, you know, that will become more obvious. So the challenge is we can't take out the inherent costs of modern production. For example, I've looked at real estate all over the country, and what's interesting is we have what we call carrying capacity. And, you know, how many animals will a piece of ground feed year round? And to break that out, we use an AU, an animal unit, which is basically a 1,000-pound cow or calf for half the year in round numbers. And so we look and say, okay, how much land do you need to take care of that animal, provide for its nutritional requirements for the year? And what's interesting is going back to that Iowa corn ground, you may be able to run one cow on 1 acre for 1 year, maybe. You can go to, you know, southeastern Colorado and you may need 30.
Right.
You may go to Utah and you may need 50 or 100. I mean, it's so subjective. And what's so interesting is when you look at the cost of real estate, it often is the same amount of net money you need to invest, whether it's for 1 acre or 10 acres. You seem to basically have to spend the same amount of total money to buy the land to support that one animal unit. The difference, though, is going to be on, can you make that land better? And one could argue that you'd be better off buying more cheaper acres in the Ozarks than less better acres in Iowa, because I can regenerate my land that's cheaper and increase my carrying capacity. And it's unlikely that I'm really going to improve on a 1 acre to one animal unit ratio, wherever in the country that may be. And so, you know, when we look at the cost of operation, we could also say, maybe we can finish a beef animal on grass alone. It has to be on what we call a rising plane of nutrition. And if that animal isn't gaining, you know, typically people say at least 3/4 of a pound per day, you're going to have tough meat, off-flavored meat, gristly meat. You know, if you look at a ribeye or a New York strip and you see that little rubber cement line around between the meat and the fat, that's traditionally caused when an animal is having to absorb its own internal fatty reserves to sustain life function due to, you know, elements of starvation, insufficient nutrition coming in. And that's why we have the fat on the back. The cow, deer, the cows, bison, bears, they all get fat in the fall and they live off that fat when times are tough throughout the wintertime. But on a cow critter that we want to enjoy eating, that isn't the most enjoyable part. And it's really obvious on a New York strip. It just, because it's right there and you can't really chew it. And we flash cook typically a New York strip, so it doesn't cook out like it would in a shoulder where we're going to roast it for 8 hours. In today's age, people want a really good steak. You know, ground beef, yeah, you can grind anything more or less and make it yummy. But a steak, everybody's an expert. Everybody has an opinion. And one bad steak will negate 9 good steaks. And so that's the challenge. So what do we do if our land doesn't produce that rising plane of nutrition throughout the year and we want to market animals and all year long? Well, we supplement. And in the old days, they'd give a little corn in the wintertime because it was really dense nutrition. And it was a way of getting them over the wintertime. And there, you know, you go way back and there was a premium for fat cattle in the wintertime because it wasn't natural. And we shifted so far with the cheap food policy and post-World War II with the amount of production and the way we've been managing for grain production. That's why so many of the cattle today are fed grain, because they can consistently deliver fat animals day in, day out, all year long. In a grass-fed world, we have to say, okay, if I'm not allowed to feed grain to hit this grass-fed criteria, what are my options? You know, depending on what protocols you adhere to, there's not a lot. So we would look at alfalfa hay, for example. Well, the country that doesn't produce year-round fattening, finishing feed via grass all year long probably isn't going to grow the alfalfa either. So now you're going to import it from, you know, 500 or 1,000 miles away, and that just raised your cost of production. So what should have been a low cost of production becomes artificially high to fit a business model, a cash flow, because you got to pay your mortgage every month or whatever your cost structures are. And that's what has turned this thing upside down. If we would go back 100, 150 years ago, where they would You know, in the Southwest and the North, they would just run these massive herds. They'd brand and castrate in the spring. They'd kick them back out and they'd do a fall gather, and everything that was over 4 years old would be trailed to the railhead and shipped to Chicago,
mm-hmm.
Or somewhere else. I mean, even a King Ranch, you go back up until about the 50s or 60s, they used to actually ship cattle from Texas up to Pennsylvania and finish them in Southeast Pennsylvania before fattening for the Philly and New York markets. You know, it's just really interesting how things changed. You know, I was just reading a biography on Teddy Roosevelt when he was ranching in the Dakotas. And, you know, there's commentary there about how these guys were saying back in that time, how impressive the grass was for periods of the year and how they could gain so well. And that's true, typically, in any part of the country for some of the year. It's just typically not true all year long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may be places in California and Virginia and so forth that you can finish out on pasture all year long, but it's very difficult. And, you know, that's why I think if our grass-fed industry is really going to mature outside of small vertically integrated programs that with, unfortunately, high cost of production, it would be to create a new model where we would take the learnings of today coupled with the knowledge of yesterday and, you know, run our extensive cow-calf herds in these far north and far south and slowly bring the calves to the center of the country where they can be finished year-round, which, quite frankly, is a modern twist on the way it used to be.
How much do you think that the corn subsidies have impacted this growth of, I don't know, feeding cows corn?
Yeah, so when you know, that's why I kind of laughed when you said keeping the government out of it. You know, it's like, you know, we've gone so far from the foundation of what this country was based on to where government has tentacles into every facet of our lives. And it's the old adage, you know, beware of a government big enough to give you everything you need because they can take everything you have.
That's right.
And so we create this terrible imbalance. And it's like with our current challenge with tariffs and whatnot, you know, it's a very complex issue with a very strong dollar and, you know, manipulated currencies worldwide, and it changes the buying power. And then we redistribute, you know, our children's income taxes to certain parts of society today to, you know, keep people in line. It creates imbalance that you just can't overcome. You know, the biofuels,
right?
Similar situation. You know, so many of these subsidies create unintended consequences, and we have short-term thinkers, you know, simply smacking band-aids all over the place rather than doing a root cause analysis and say, what actually caused this mess in the first place? And are we going to dig back deep enough and find out where the problem is? So you got to shorten the ground. You don't just, you know, try to pour rubber all over everything so nobody gets shocked. You dig it up and you fix it. And that's part of our problem today is we're dealing with these imbalances, you know, government intervention that has led to these scenarios, and it becomes very complex. And we also have a lot of consolidation in all industries, but germane to this discussion in the beef packing industry. You know, we've got, I believe it is 4 primary packers that control approximately 80% of the fed cattle in this country. And so, they now own or forward contract a lot of these cattle. So the free cash market is greatly limited and its impact. And it's, you know, unfortunately, without some sort of change in course, beef cow are headed in the direction of beef, pork and chicken, which is all vertically integrated through a few big players. And the farmer serfs that serve them, you know, are not independent. They pat themselves on the back and tell themselves they're independent, you know, because they don't punch a clock. But the reality is they're in debt to their eyebrows to build grower barns on contracts, and they're basically paid to turn the lights on and off. I mean, it's really a shame where we've gone.
Are you talking about like the chicken barns?
Chicken barns, hog barns, you betcha.
Okay.
And so again, it's the policy of government, which policy is spread in different ways. You know, a lot of it's through the land-based, land-grant university systems and that are training the next generation of managers. And through the farm bills, and you know, there's just a variety of ways that they influence markets. And it has made, the good news is we spend, I believe, is the least amount of money per income dollar to buy food in this country world than we do anywhere else in the world. But there are ramifications of that. And we have a degrading soil base. We have the impact of those choices over the last 50 or 60 years is beginning to be felt. And the good news is we can change our management practices and we can reverse all of that. It's not doom and gloom, unless, of course, we put our head in the sand and don't make the hard choices.
So talking about the changing things around, we have farmland and we also have cattle practices. Let's just take a look at the farmland. If we took that farmland and we were going to try to regenerate it, would the best practice be to convert it to just grassland and just regenerate it that way? Or how would you do that?
Well, if I were dictator of the world.
Let's go for it. Let's hear what do you got?
That's dangerous. But it'd be fun for a few minutes. Yes, the short answer is yes. But that brings into question a whole host of other things, and dietary choice. And, there's just a lot of misunderstanding out there about human health and nature and what we should eat and what we shouldn't eat and how it should be produced. And, mm-hmm. There's just a huge debacle. And a lot of it, is hype and drama and emotion. The reality is the Great Plains that are growing all of our corn and soybeans
used to be the grasslands.
Absolutely. And it was large herb.
Not the grass we see today.
And it's interesting is there are a few little set-aside prairie areas and there's no animals on them and they're degrading. Because a lot of people do not fully appreciate the relationship between large herds of grazing animals and grasses and the resulting soil from that relationship. And so we can produce the same number of calories by going to grass-fed meats and reverse, the negative soil and health of our environment by changing those practices. And there are a lot of good people who are doing it today, using what they have where they are, and that's great. Unfortunately, back to the government, there's just a huge subsidy system that is making it very, very difficult to see landscape scale change. But the conversation is gaining energy and people are beginning to realize, especially this year, with the extreme rains in parts of the country and the impact on planting and yield and so forth. And of course, what do we have? We have government subsidies, crops, insurances, and now you can get insurance if you didn't plant your ground or if you had to replant your ground. And there's this whole system
right
that keeps us from making genuine progress.
So while we were talking about the grasslands, I'm sitting here thinking, I think that still yet, even if we went complete grass-fed beef, and that's how we're feeding everybody, there's still a component where you're, in effect, lessening the amount of carbon returned to the soil.
You're missing the one key point that makes it all work.
I'm listening.
And that is the energy from the sun via photosynthesis. And that is what keeps it growing. A lot of people will think the way you just described and they'll say, all we can do is reduce the rate of degradation. And I say, no, because that's the thing is we've been granted this great gift of energy from the sun and the photosynthesis. And, if the sun blows up and just continues giving us energy, I think we have another conversation to be had. But until that time, that is our source of energy. And
sure,
the vast majority of all things on this earth start with energy from the sun in some fashion. And that's the beauty of grasslands is that they will always absorb that sun by photosynthesis and grow plant life. And that's what stimulates the entire cycle. Our water cycles, our nutrient cycles, our energy flow, it all stems from that sun process. So we can take meat and milk and eggs off the land and not degrade the land. Now, ultimately, we would minimize that impact by returning the guts and the bones and the hide, whatever we don't use, or when we're done using it, nonetheless, return it to the land. That would be preferable.
Right.
But in the absence of being able to go completely native, it still comes out to a net positive because of photosynthesis.
I was thinking a little bit more of the organic matter, because if you took out too much, even if you do have a lot of sun, if you took out too much organic material, you still have the sun, you're trying to plant things, the grass wouldn't even grow well because you've diminished the organic matter so much. It's a sliding scale.
And again, it all depends on what is the harvest method. Are you taking off corn silage, which is cut at a couple inches above the ground, and the entire plant and the grain are taken out? Are you just taking off shell corn, which is just the seed portion, the cob and the plant stay on the land? Or are you taking off just the surplus energy via meat, milk, or eggs, because everything else that didn't go into the meat, milk, and eggs was returned to that earth via dung?
Right.
So that's where that balance, the portion you're taking off is actually less than the energy absorbed by sunlight, which is what allows us to regenerate. So that's where moving to an animal-based diet and moving to a grassland-based food production system is actually net positive. And that's the great fallacy of this plant-based drivel, is that, you know, there's so much absurdity in our media today. It's like everybody just, if you just claim loudly and consistently a falsehood and no one challenges it, eventually it becomes accepted truth.
Right.
And people say, well, we know it's better for the planet. Is it better for your health? And it's like, well, wait a second. I disagree. It's not better for the planet. It's what's led to the degradation of our planet. You know, there's university numbers that suggest for every pound of corn produced in Iowa, a pound of topsoil is lost. So, you know, whether you want to use your bank account or cookie jar, the analogy is the same. You can only take out indefinitely. And if you don't replenish, you run out.
Right.
And the reality is people say, oh, it's doom and gloom. It's, you know, scary. And, you know, you're one of these and one of those. And it's like, no, it's really just logic. So the question is, are we going to sit here and twist our hands and say, oh, no, the sky is falling? Or are we going to get our big boy pants on and go out and make a change?
Right.
Because we can. That's the beauty of regeneration. It is the only model out here in natural resource stewardship that actually offers genuine hope. The reality is, though, is there are a lot of vested interests that would like to dissuade us from that path simply because there's nothing to sell.
That's right.
There's no tractors, trucks, corn, genetics. It's a change has to happen between our ears. And that's open source knowledge. You don't have to pay for it. Now, you can go to a class and pay to go to a conference or something, but essentially it's open source knowledge.
Right.
So vested interest in food and ag, you know, it's a double-edged sword. They promote this and ride the wave, realizing, you know, that at the end of the day, you know, they're giving away competitive advantage. Or do they kind of restrict and say, no, that's a bunch of horse pucky and, you know, this is the only way we're actually going to feed, you know, the population in 2050 when it hits whatever the number is. And, you know, again, it's what is truth? You have to look, it's the old adage, follow the money. And the truth changes with those interests, typically. Not that I have any opinion.
Well, when you do actually settle into something that you're willing to commit to, let me know and we'll talk about that. You have absolutely posted a lot about solar on LinkedIn, and I'm sure in different places. How has solar impacted, just tell me about solar, how it's impacted your farm, how it's impacted others, and why is it beneficial? And when I talk about solar, I'm talking about solar panels.
I understand. So I don't know a lot about solar energy as it pertains to the panels. My involvement starts with managing the vegetation under those panels. That being said, there is a large footprint under panel development. You know, to create the panels themselves and ship components and build sites, and there's typically a lot of degradation in the process of building a site, a solar farm. And that puts them at, you know, a negative number in my mind on, you know, the positive impact. And so we talk about renewables, and that's going to save us from coal and nuclear and whatever. And yet, in and of itself, I think there's a reasonable argument of whether or not that's genuine. And I think a lot of people that only look at the surface will say, well, it, you know, it's sunlight, it's renewable, therefore it's better. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm not here to say one way or the other, but I am saying that it may not be. However, through collaborative approaches like we have with Silicon Ranch Corporation out of Nashville, they're one of the larger solar operators, and they have created a program they call Regenerative Energy. And it's using in part, our ecological health index, our ecological outcome verification system from Savory, which we're using as operators on the land to show how the land is improving. And they had the vision to say, you know what, we're spraying chemicals, we're cutting with mowers, and, you know, the environment in and around and under our panels is degrading as a result, which from a business point of view has long-term repercussions. That land has to be managed, you know, erosion has to be dealt with, runoff has to be dealt with. Plus, from a marketing point of view, if people are buying renewables because they think it's going to somehow be better, but the land is degrading on these solar farms, that's the challenge. And so they had the vision to say, you know what, let's not just do sheet plus solar, let's actually put together a system whereby managing the vegetation, which is a requirement, is done in a fashion that actually rehabilitates the site, i.e. regenerates the site. And so that's where we were given the opportunity, in large part because of our work with the Savory Institute and, you know, in our proximity to a lot of their solar fields here in the Mid-South. And it's been a really interesting journey. It hasn't been easy. There is a lot to learn. And yet, you know, we're coming to the close of the growing season, and we finally feel like we can come up for a little bit of air. There's just so much we didn't know. And quite frankly, I'm pretty pleased with how the year has gone, all things considered, because it could have been a colossal failure. We just, so much we didn't know.
Is this the first year you've started doing this?
Yes, sir. And we started that project in particular after the growing season had already started. And, you know, we found some sites that we're in a little bit rougher shape than maybe we thought they might be. And of course, we had great rainfall this year from a grass growing perspective. And it's like my first time in my life as a grazier, I'm sitting there going, we might actually have more rain than we want because the grass is getting ahead of us.
Right.
And when you're in a solar situation, you can't have shading, which is when the grass, you know, literally shades the sunlight from hitting the panels. And you can't have vegetation that's intertwined, entangled, or touching a lot of the mechanics of the solar arrays. So, you know, that was one of the things.
When you say mechanics, what does it mean? Do they move, or are they
wires underneath the panels? There's wires, and you know that you can have a microclimate underneath those arrays, and humidity from the vegetation being too tall and limiting airflow that can potentially lead to corrosion, things of that nature. So, we have specifications we have to operate within to manage the vegetation. And we're operating on a significant amount of acres spread across a number of states. And so it all grows at the same level. And as a grazier, we look at grass as stored forage. That's winter feed. And that's money in the bank, so to speak. And yet when you're sitting there going, okay, it's now approaching a point where it's jeopardizing the function of the solar array, it needs to be managed for logical reasons and contractual reasons. And so, you know, that was part of our learning curve. And of course, the logistics of moving equipment and animals and people around. To my knowledge, there's nobody grazing as many acres under solar spread across as many sites as across as many states as we are today. And one thing we're very grateful for is we don't see that we made a lot of mistakes. We didn't get the wrong equipment or go about it wrong. There was just a hell of a learning curve. And we feel like, you know, like I mentioned a minute ago, we're kind of coming to that back to the surface. We were kind of underwater for the last month as we're trying to get caught up on vegetation management, veg man. And, you know, we're feeling really optimistic and looking forward to next year, because we're going to go into the next year having the sites in shape, mm-hmm. having our equipment rigged up, and having our team knowledgeable about what we need to do. And so, you know, it's like any other business. Your startup year is a son of a gun. And, you know, we're super optimistic that what we've learned is going to stand us in good stead. We're being granted additional properties, which we're really excited about, you know, which greatly helps, you know, the economics of our proposal. And so we're feeling really good about it. And we're just so grateful that, you know, Silicon Ranch has given us this opportunity. We take it very, very seriously. And we have busted our humps to do a good job. And, you know, and they've been understanding, you know, when things got out of control, they clearly let us know, but they also understood that it was a learning curve,
right?
And that, you know, we were correcting it. As soon as we knew there was a problem, we were there, we were fixing it. And so, you know, it's been good, stressful, but good.
That's awesome. And it's a way of, I don't know, it's a new opportunity since this is a totally new industry.
Well,
I say totally new, but you know what I mean.
So it is. No, you're right. You're right. And this collaborative approach is relatively new and groundbreaking. And part of the value to me personally is, you know, I was not born into this industry. I was not born landed. So we've done a lot of things to get what we have. And yet I have six children, and the ones that are, you know, coming of age want to be involved in this kind of pursuit. And for us to go out and just start buying more property and then buying cattle to put on them, it's just not realistic. You know, we don't have the economics to afford that.
Mm-hmm.
But with this kind of program where we're getting compensated to take care of the vegetation on these properties, now we can grow and we can bring the children into the operation. And it's a matter of, you know, we have to have the equipment and we have to have the animals,
mm-hmm.
but we don't have to buy the land.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, I honestly believe that solar grazing is probably, if not the brightest opportunity in agriculture today, it's damn sure near the top. I don't know of anything else that will allow more new people and young people to be able to enter agriculture than this. And I believe that a deep understanding of regenerative agriculture and the ability to apply it is going to be a highly in-demand skill set for a long time. People who not only know how to manage natural resources, but aren't afraid of getting dirty, aren't afraid of putting in the long hours and doing the rough job. You know, I think your whole podcast is around blue collar, and I think you'll appreciate, and your listeners will, that there's a lot of people today who just aren't willing to do it anymore. You know, so people who are willing to get dirty and work hard, put the time in, but do it in a well thought out method with a pattern, with a plan, with a context, I think the future is very, very bright. And I think the opportunity of being able to apply that skill and energy in a situation like solar grazing, where your operational costs should be met
mm-hmm.
through your veg management contract, now your agriculture enterprise, the raising of the animals, has much lower costs against it, which means that even in a very tight commodity world, there should be a margin. And if and when one has the time to pursue premium markets, that could be an adage as well. I mean, we talk about solar grazing to the average consumer. And, you know, we were at a conference a couple of months ago, and we were talking about regenerative ag, and consumers kind of have this, you know, blank look on their face, but they nod their head because they heard the word somewhere and they don't want to feel stupid. So they say, yeah, they get it. And, you know, they don't. And then you give them a word picture and say, you know what, solar panels, renewable energy. And they're like, yeah. And I said, now there's grass growing underneath there and it needs to be managed. So instead of using herbicide or lawnmowers, we're grazing sheep underneath there to do the same job. And you see the light bulb in their eyes. Mm-hmm. They get it. They're like, oh, that's what regenerative agriculture is. And they understand it. So I think there's a marketing option for the food product that's produced by this grazing style in the future, not there today. But it's there in the future. But the benefit too to the solar operator is to say, you know what? We're not putting herbicides. We're not putting, you know, there's a certain amount of irony in, you know, using fossil fuels to manage vegetation under renewable energy, right? I mean, so, you know, granted we still use diesel trucks, but maybe one day we'll run some other kind of energy truck. But the point is we're reducing the amount of fossil fuels being used to manage the site under solar. And we're a giant benefit is that we're not taking this acreage out of food production. You know, right now our population is forecast to grow.
Right.
And, you know, there are people who are saying, no, can we feed them? Well, of course we can. We just need to pull our heads out first and think about this more holistically. So yes, you know, thanks to solar grazing and the organizations that have been willing to pioneer this, you can eat a cooked steak in light. And that's pretty cool.
Well, that's definitely some good stuff. The regenerative, it matters so much to me that our soil is taken care of, that everything is done in a manner. I hate killing the soil. And I know that we do that all over the place. And it pains me. I'm not a tree hugger, but I still think that we need to take good care of our earth.
Yeah, it's our responsibility. We're stewards of it.
You've brought up a lot of good stuff and interesting things that you're doing. I have a few questions for you that'll be like really quick to answer as we start winding this down.
Yeah.
So I saw a video hauling manure using draft horses with your name on workingranchmag.com. Was that you?
That was probably my son in the picture, but yes, we have used draft horses for many, many years.
That's cool. My brother's real big into wanting to work with draft horses and he's done a little training. He's about, you know, he's not an expert or anything, but he's tinkered with it a little bit, and it was just kind of interesting. When you're using your draft horses, is this to help protect the soil? Is it just more ecologically advantageous? Why do you use the draft horses?
Well, for a variety of reasons. Honestly, mostly because I love horses.
there you go.
But
that's a damn good reason.
I come up with a lot of additional reasons to justify to less emotional people why it makes sense. But you know, I love the idea of having a system that does not really require additional inputs or outside inputs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll ever get there to full neutrality, on inputs, but I'd like to think we get to a net positive carbon position. Maybe we're there now. I don't know. But, the idea of importing fuel from wherever to run a tractor to haul manure or whatever it is we do, it just doesn't feel right. And to see this expensive equipment sitting idle, I mean, I don't know how people get into grain farming today. You know, millions of dollars worth of equipment that might only be used for 6 weeks out of the year. I mean, it's just depreciating and, it's a real challenge. Whereas, you know, we prefer to put our money in something that reproduces or at least gains weight. And so with horses, we usually have a couple of colts a year, whether they're through our saddle horses or draft horses. And, it's just fun. Now, if a guy doesn't enjoy working with horses, it's probably not a great idea. But I also want my children to learn these things and have these skill sets. And there's the only way we'll perpetuate any of these skills and crafts is by teaching our children. And, having the odd toe get stepped on or the thumb smashed or, you know, working long hours. I mean, I tell you what, you sleep a hell of a lot better when you've worked hard all day and have a belly full of good food.
Well, that's
and
for sure.
A lot of people today have trouble sleeping. And maybe if they went out and worked for 12 hours, they wouldn't have that problem.
I've certainly been there, and I like to back off on the 12 hours a little bit. I'll just be honest.
fair enough. But, you know, not all work is digging ditches. Sometimes work is leaning against the fence, thinking about how to run your operation better.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. If you're spending the time thinking and doing, you could have 8 hours that aren't physically demanding, but yet you could still feel like you've been beat up at the end of the day.
You know, I've worked a lot, you know, on both physical and direct involvement and also in desk work. And I tell you what, you know, a lot of times in the consulting world, it's hard to get satisfaction. It's hard to feel any sense of accomplishment. And you can go out and you can clean a barn or haul manure or sort cattle or whatever. You're tired, but you're happy.
Mm-hmm.
You did something, you see the result of what you did, and mm-hmm. it's so satisfying.
Sure.
And I think a lot of us today have lost that sense of satisfaction that really only comes from seeing progress, because so much of our intellectual work or you know, office work, as it were, maybe your inbox is empty, but I mean, it doesn't really give you that sense of completion that physical work does. And not everybody enjoys it, and that's fine. Everything in moderation, but it is really, and that's one thing, you know, this year I've really focused on building this solar grazing enterprise. I've been extremely hands-on. I think between my son and I, we're close to 60,000 miles since the middle of April on our trucks, but I don't know if there's a lot of people that know how to do what we do better than we do at this point. It's been a deep immersion into this. You know, if we're going to grow this, I feel a deep sense of responsibility to industry to do it right.
Right.
It's my personal pride. It's the way I was raised, but it's also, when I said I believe this is the brightest star in ag today, I believe it. And I don't want to be the reason that isn't achieved. So we've done a huge deep dive. We made a lot of sacrifice and commitment. Our family has gone through a lot this year while we've built this program, but it's been for, you know, I guess in my mind, it may sound cliche, but I think it's for a bigger value, a greater good. And, you know, I can see other young people that have an opportunity to get involved with this and family operations that are maybe, you know, in a tough spot that may be able to branch out.
Sure.
You know, and improve their income streams. And so I'm pretty optimistic about it. And we've taken this year to do that. And it's been satisfying. So, you know, it's all good.
Have you held any classes or training or helped other people move to this or do it in addition? I mean, have you trained?
We've introduced some people, not on a large scale. We actually are getting some intern requests and follow up on some of them for maybe next year. We've brought a couple people into our program that, you know, live more or less adjacent to our operating areas to reduce some of the mileage moving forward. And also too, as we grow and open up new areas. And, you know, there's some other solar grazers or people that are interested that we've taken some time, some we've done some touring with. But, you know, this year was really, you know, keeping our heads down and doing mm-hmm. our work. But we certainly see the opportunity. I know I'm scheduled to be involved in some conferences throughout the winter season to spread that word a little bit further and broader. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. And it's not for everyone. But I think, you know, for those that are looking for a way in,
mm-hmm.
this could be an excellent solution.
Okay. So how did you decide on Quebrejo for your ranch name?
Yeah, so it's a made-up word of Cabra and Viejo, which is goat and old. Like I said earlier, we're cheesemakers for many years and had submitted a aged goat cheese to a competition. And actually, in 2005, we won the U.S. Cheese Championship gold medal.
Nice.
For aged goat cheese with that cheese. And I didn't have a name for it, because quite frankly, I didn't think it was all that good. But, you know, when it won, we had people start asking, what do you call this cheese? And I said, oh, it's just old goat cheese. We had some Guatemalans working with us at the time, and I was like, what do you call old goat in Spanish? Tabra Viejo. No one's going to be able to pronounce that. How about Tabriejo? And unfortunately, a lot of people still can't pronounce it. But nonetheless, no one else uses that word.
Hey, like, I was one of them.
Right? Yeah, that's the story behind it. It's basically old goat. And, you know, a lot of our opportunities have stemmed from the recognition of receiving that award. So when we rebranded ourselves, when we moved to the Ozarks years ago, we started our business using that name.
Awesome. Do you still make cheese?
No, not right now. We actually still have basically a brand new cheese plant on our operation, but we've discontinued that about 2 years ago. The climate for dairy and specialty foods is very complicated today with food safety and insurance and distribution and warehousing, and it was difficult to be competitive. And so while we had opportunity and enjoyed it, particularly as the children were getting older and realizing that, you know, this is an area that is only going to become more complicated and challenging. Mm-hmm. So we just did some real heart-to-heart discussions with the family and, you know, went, reviewed the finances and reviewed, you know, the responsibilities. And we have the plant, you know, it's just a matter of flipping the switch and we could be back in. We want to reserve that opportunity should some of the younger children decide they want to pick it up, be fully supportive of that with the commitment. But for now, we've chosen to focus on other areas.
Okay. So you say you're in the Ozarks. You moved there. What led you deciding that the Ozarks was the place for you?
A consulting gig. That simple. I mean, I always wanted to go west, and I just didn't figure I'd stop in the middle, and maybe I won't. But I'm here now. I've been here for about 10 years, and you know, it's nice. It's a good place to live. It really is.
Does it get hot and humid there in the summer?
Yeah, yeah. We're just north of the Arkansas line a little ways, and you know, we get plenty of humidity and plenty of heat, but we still get, you know, a good chunk of four seasons. And, you know, we get over 50 inches of rain most years. And it's a good place to live. You know, we live 30 miles from the closest traffic light.
Mm, that sounds great.
Can't see anybody from our place. So,
oh, that's the best.
Our county has, I want to say it's the lowest population per mile, where I believe our current level is at 13 people per square mile in our county. So, from my way of thinking, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Trent, it has been a true pleasure. I have really enjoyed speaking with you and hearing what you got going on and learning. There's so much to learn, and I love what you're doing. I really like your approach. I thank you so much for taking the time and sharing with everybody all this stuff. And before we do go, is there anything else that you'd like to address that we haven't talked about yet?
Probably not, other than to thank you for the opportunity to share. I know I've got some strong opinions. I do try to temper them, but I get kind of excited and they just come out. But, you know, the key here is that we don't have it figured out at all. We figured out a lot of stuff that doesn't work. We're trying to avoid those mistakes again. But it's a process. It's a journey. And every day is a new opportunity. And, you know, we just fully believe that this is the path that we should be on. You know, we've made mistakes. We're not limiting our ability to be successful in the future because of past mistakes. It's a learning process, and we're just enjoying the journey. You know, it's awesome to be able to spend a lot of time with my family and work with my children and teaching them how to work. And, you know, it's just good. And I just encourage anybody that has a dream to just go for it. And don't be afraid of making mistakes. It's the only way we learn, and we won't know what we're truly capable of unless we try.
Exactly.
You know, this year has been an excellent reminder for me personally of that, and I just encourage anyone else that's sitting there at a crossroads and say, you know, go for it. Don't hold back. You have nothing to lose. I mean, you came into this world with nothing. You're going to go out with nothing. You know.
That's some real good advice. I love it. Trent, thank you so much, and I will see you online, sir.
Our next guest on the Blue Collar Voices show is Mark LeConte. Here's a short little snippet.
Then the next thing you know, you just have too much to do. So you got to start to figure out, do I spend any time with the family? Because you're working nights, weekends, plus your regular full-time job, 40 hours a week during the week. And at that point, I was getting called in for overtime quite a bit. And that was at the, you know, at your regular full-time job. And my job was no different than everyone else's. There's mandatory overtime. There's overtime you don't have to take. But when you're called and if you answer the phone, you're coming in. So,
tag, you're it.
Yep. Tag, you're it. So once that got over, I had to get comfortable with the feeling of letting that job go, you know, and making the leap. And when I felt I had enough, and it was 2008 is when that happened. So it was about 10 years after I started. And that's when I reclassified myself as, not reclassified. I'm going to say I classified myself appropriately as your home repair professional. I'm not a handyman. I'm a home repair professional.
Hey guys, before you go, two things. The first is I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. I realize this is an older podcast, but I'm updating this podcast in November 2019 for the announcement of an upcoming road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and or video. Please check out the website for more information. I'd love to hear from you. Email me at johnc@bluecollarvoices.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Thanks all. Looking forward to hearing from you. Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.